Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Hey, good morning, Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demmer Cinceri, All Things Legal, Albert's taking off. Wish you a happy Mother's Day. You give us a call at 260-1870, and we got Michelle.
It's Labor Day.
What did I say?
Mother's Day.
Did I say Mother's Day? Cause, yeah. No, because you're a mom, I guess. I was thinking because you're here.
Oh, okay.
It's Labor Day. I said Mother's Day?
You did.
You got to be kidding me.
No, it's okay.
That's scary. That's scary.
We are. It is kind of scary.
What did I say, Mother's Day?
Yeah.
You got to be kidding me.
No, sorry.
So, I don't know what's on my brain there.
I have no idea.
All Things Legal. Give us a call at 260-1870 or you can text us on our Facebook feed. We're streaming live on our law firm and our personal Facebook feed, All Things Legal, from downtown Mandeville. Well, not downtown. We're a suburb of Mandeville.
We're not even in Mandeville proper. I think Mandeville proper is like a square block.
Yeah, so we're some, you know, in God's country in the North Shore. So, well, thank you for traversing the hallway for joining us.
You're welcome.
This is nice, huh? We used to have to drive across the bridge.
We did.
We don't have to do that anymore. It's really nice. So Labor Day. You know what? When, growing up, thinking of Labor Day, there's two things I think about.
What?
Hurricanes in the Gulf and Jerry Lewis.
Yeah, that's true.
We don't have either this weekend.
That was one of my favorite things about Labor Day.
Jerry Lewis?
Yeah. We used to collect money in our neighborhood when we were growing up. And then one of the parents would bring us down to the TV station, and we'd try to get on the TV and give them our, you know, bag of quarters, whatever it was we collected.
I liked that entertainment. It was almost like the Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin type of entertainers. When we were kids.
The drunk ones.
That's why I liked them so much.
But like we would stay, so my mom's family would get together, all my cousins, and we would stay up like all night.
Right, that's great entertainment.
That was great. It was like something we looked forward to every year. And then as I got older, you know, our youngest is born, and so it's like tomorrow is Labor Day, and tomorrow's her birthday, so that's always fun.
I know. Well, it's but we don't have a hurricane of Gulf. I always think usually there's something even off the coast of Africa or something people are worried about. But we don't have that. And, you know, Jerry Lewis has moved on.
He has.
And I used to love – well, he actually – Dean Martin reunited with Jerry Lewis in 1977 maybe. They were apart for 20 years. I mean, they were it. They were bigger than the Beatles when they were hot. Huh. They were.
Yeah, that was before my time.
It was before mine, but – I'm a fan. I love Dean Martin.
You were
man.
Born at the wrong time.
I was. I should have been born about 40 years earlier.
So. And then yesterday morning, we were a little bit in the morning because we didn't have game day. So we were.
I know. It's Labor Day. That's the first weekend of game day. I turn it on and you know.
I think
we
were watching a 20-year-old game or something.
No, they had a couple games on. They had Army on. Army rolled. Army's not worried about the COVID. They played football there, so they're not worried about that. So they did good. And I think they had a couple other – it was just good to see a little football.
Yeah.
I did miss game day. But LSU would have been playing, I think, UT San Antonio this weekend. But it is what it is. Speaking of which – so we're going to be on next weekend. The Saints play at 3:30, so we'll be on next week.
Okay.
And they play Tampa, and they made their cuts. And that's all I got to say about the Saints. And let's talk about
people. Are they having people play? I mean, watch
game? No, they're not.
They're gonna have paper cardboard people like they do at the baseball games.
I don't know what they're gonna do. Well, that's another. Next subject. LSU.
Let's keep rolling.
I'll talk about LSU.
Okay, let's talk about LSU.
You know, I wanted to talk about this, Coach O. We were fans of Coach the day he was. Hired as interim, we said he should be head coach. Play the tape, right?
Yeah.
We were big old fans.
We are.
And I was thinking about this. because I had time to think yesterday because we did nothing except just lie around and turned off our brain.
Football.
Yeah. But Coach O, I was thinking about the coaches at LSU. And why is Coach O so good? Why has he been so good for LSU? And I do have a theory, among other things.
Okay, why?
Okay, let me give you a historical background about LSU football and their coaches.
Okay.
You had, when I grew up, there was Charlie McClendon.
Okay.
He was always one or two games away from being SEC champion and being a, you know, powerhouse. They were just good. They had great defense, good running game, but they were sort of archaic in their offense. In fact, Burt Jones, who's the best? I mean, he was like John Elway.
Wasn't that the jersey you wore and you would never take off?
Yeah, Tommy Casanova and Burt Jones. At St. Angela,
yeah.
I'd wear it under my uniform. I'd never take it off. After about 15 days.
I'm so sorry for the people who sat around you.
I know, Miss Schaff. Miss Schaff would say, please wash that jersey. In fact, I wore it so much that it used to walk around my bedroom by itself. And so that's Burt Jones. Actually, you know, with Bill Becknell, I'll have to tell a Burt Jones story.
Okay.
I'll tell two stories when I went work for Bill, who was general counsel for John Meekum. Remind me later. It was great. It was great. I was thrilled. And it's in the context of me watching Burt Jones. But he only played half the game. Charlie McClendon had a two-tier. He played the backups as much as the starters almost. And I'm like, you had Burt Jones, you had John Elway, and you only played half the game. So they really didn't make the national championship. Then you had Bo Ryan, who was hired after Charlie McClendon in 1980. But he had he died in a plane crash right after he got hired.
Oh, yeah, we saw that.
Yeah,
saw that.
He played under Lou Holtz, and he had some. He probably would have been there for 20, 25 years. And after that, Jerry Stovall took over. And Jerry took over under very difficult circumstances. He didn't even have his own coaches.
Right.
So he did win an Orange Bowl. I don't think he ever really got the opportunity to do things the way he needed to do it because he came in as a stopgap, and so he was gone. And then
how
they
long
had
was he there?
4 years, from 1980 to 1984. Then you had Bill Ornsberger. Now, they called him the old man
because
he came from the Miami Dolphins. He won several Super Bowls as the defensive coordinator, but they called him the old man.
Why?
Because he was the same age as me. It's true. Like, you know, our friend Jamie Bice. He's now a federal court, I mean, a state, city court judge in Lake Charles.
Right.
He was the safety. He was great because he brought discipline to those kids. I mean, real discipline, NFL discipline. And they won two Sugar Bowls, a couple SECs, and he retired because he only stayed 3 years. They said if he would have stayed a fourth year, they would have won a national championship because he was like Nick Saban as far as discipline and football knowledge. Then you had the next two coaches. You had Mike Archer, who was his assistant. He was like 32 years old, too young, too inexperienced, couldn't handle it. And that was the descent of the LSU program from 1986 to about 1990. Then you had Curly Hallman, who was a disaster. I mean, look, if the guys.
How do you really feel about that?
No, well, I mean, if you on your resume, you apply for LSU and your name's Curly, that should have known something there. But anyway, Curly was a disaster. And at that time, all the great players in Louisiana were going to other states. You had Patrick Riley going to Miami. You had Leroy Horde going to Michigan. You had Tyrone Hughes going to Nebraska. It was just. And so then he was fired. And then you brought Jerry DiNardo, who we got to – he did a little work for Coach. Mm-hmm. And what he did was he said, we're going to put a fence around the state of Louisiana. And he did accomplish that. Alan Faneca stayed, Kevin Falk. So they started – they had a couple of Independence Bowls, a Peach Bowl, but they couldn't get over the top. He was fired. Then they brought Nick Saban. What can I say about that? And then they brought Les Miles, Albert Nico's favorite coach.
I don't
right?
know Albert likes any coaches.
I know. He's sort of – some people say he's a curmudgeon, huh?
Oh,
no,
okay.
No, I didn't say that.
I just think he's highly opinionated.
He's highly opinionated. Well, we're lawyers.
I know.
That comes That's with territory. He's not a curmudgeon. I didn't say that.
I didn't say that.
No, he's very thoughtful.
I hope he's sleeping.
I hope so. No, he's just getting in. It's Labor Day. He is just coming in right now. He'll be waking up to about 4 o'clock this afternoon. He said, but so we got. I hear music, but we're gonna do this. And then they got Les Miles. Les Miles was great at recruiting, but after the break, I'm going to tell you what Coach O did differently.
Okay.
Because Coach Miles was a great, great recruiter, but here was the difference with Coach O and why he's winning. So we'll be right back on All Things Legal right after this brief timeout. We'll talk about law, too, in a second.
There you go.
Hey, we're back. Doug Sincera, Michelle Demerson, Sarah. It's a law show. But I'm going to finish my little LSU history lesson.
All right, because I've been hanging on.
History.
I know.
Why has Coach O been so successful?
I don't know.
I'm going to tell you why.
Why?
Les Miles used to get the 4 and 5, had to share 4 or 5 star players.
Right.
But Coach O develops the 2 and 3 star players. Now, like usually when you come out of college, you use 5, 4, 3, 2 star players. Well, I'll give you an example. And this is what you need to do this year because they only have 5 starters coming back. Only 5 out of 22 starters.
I think we dropped to like number 6. Huh?
Oh, we're going to – well, it's going to be tough.
I mean, yesterday morning.
But we took Clyde Edwards-Hilaire, who was just a 2 to 3 star,
right,
made him a superstar. Justin Jefferson, who was a throw-in, they signed him. I think he was the last person signed in his class because his two brothers played. Mm. He was like a legacy signing.
Right.
I mean, I think he was 2-star, first-round pick. Joe Burrow on the scrap heap at Ohio State, 3-star quarterback. Wasn't really sought after outside of the state of Ohio. But for his father was a football coach. Look what happened to him.
There you go.
And then you had Thaddeus Moss. Transfer from North Carolina State, Randy Moss's son, last year. That's the difference with Coach O. He takes the 2 and 3 star players and makes them 4 and 5 star players. That's it.
It is.
Among other things.
Among other things.
Among other things. I guess when we see Coach April this afternoon, we'll ask him, huh?
Yep.
But we got phone calls. We're
going
to transition. Let's go to Justin.
Show.
It's Justin. Hey, Justin. You on All Things Legal. Justin.
Doug and Michelle, good morning.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning, Justin.
Just for the listeners, Justin's the official trust beneficiary of the Nico and Tenseri Law Firm Trust, which is totally
unfunded.
Well, that
means I get $1 million, right?
No, it's unfunded.
No, it's unfunded right now.
It's a privilege without monetary reward.
Oh, that is so sweet. I enjoy talking to you guys. I have a legal question, but when you brought up, Doug, when you brought up Jerry Lewis.
Yes.
Did you know that Jerry Lewis's goddaughter, his godchild, is Buddy Rich? His
Buddy
daughter.
Rich, really, the great drummer, and you're the great drummer.
Great drummer. His daughter is Jerry Lewis's godfather. I'm goddaughter.
Got it. Now, you used to watch Johnny Carson. You had to.
I did. I, of course, I did. Sure.
Buddy Rich was one of Johnny Carson's favorite guests because he always wanted to be a drummer. Did you know that?
I did know that. And actually, Johnny Carson did play drums.
He did.
But he never met Buddy Rich. And Buddy Rich was on Johnny Carson probably like 3 times a year. So
yes.
They were close friends. But when I heard that Jerry Lewis was the godfather of Buddy Rich's daughter, I'd say, wow, it's a small world, isn't it?
It is. Well, Hollywood back then was. Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's funny.
Jerry Lewis's son was a... He had a group in the 60s.
Did you really?
Gary Lewis and the...
Gary Lewis?
Oh, Gary Lewis. I know who that is.
That was his son. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Absolutely.
Oh, like Gary Lewis and the Playboys, I think they called.
Yeah, that was it. That was his son.
You got a lot of information in that head,
look,
huh?
I got a lot of useless knowledge. it's only good on City Boy.
Well, here's my law question.
Yes.
About landlords and evictions and the federal government, the state government, and the city government saying you can't kick somebody out because of COVID. Well, I've been paying my rent all through this thing. Mm-hmm. And I could have gone to my landlord, who's a really nice guy. great family. And I could have told him, oh, I'm not paying you. I get to stay in my apartment. That's not fair to them.
Well,
make sense?
That is happening in a lot of occasions with landlords. Now, one of the myths about landlords is you think these landlords are like these robber barons that have thousands and thousands of units, like, you know, like the guy on It's a Wonderful Life. Who was his name?
Right, yeah.
You know, but it's not true. Most landlords in Louisiana have less than 10 units,
right,
or in state city. And most of them have notes. And if they don't have money coming in,
they can't pay
their
notes.
They're defaulting on their notes. And
right.
So it's you know, it's a problem that, you know, you can't – I don't know what the solution is, but, yes, with the situation that you're saying –
Well, see wait, hold on a second. I'm a mechanic. I work on cars.
Uh-huh.
And I can't find the solution until I know what the problem is. Well, now I know what the problem is, but I can't find the solution.
Right.
And it's not fair. It's not fair. For my landlord, and I hate that word, but I'm going to use that for simplicity's sake.
Yeah.
It's not fair for him to pay property taxes and take care of my building, and I'm not paying rent. That's so not fair.
Well,
and for the government to force the landlords not to pay, not to force their tenants out. I mean, I'm telling you, if I missed one rent payment, I'd be out on the street.
Right. Well, like I said, not Mr. Potter on It's a Wonderful Life. Most landlords are, you know, are middle, you know, small middle. I know we had clients who were two postmen there, and they worked for the post office. They
mm-hmm.
saved all their money to buy a few rental units, and now it's not coming
yeah.
in, and they use all their retirement. So those are the typical landlords, and there are people who we've come across, not all people, because some people are experiencing hardship. And if you're experiencing hardship, what my recommendation would be, if you can't pay all of it, work with your landlord to show good faith. Just to show good faith that you're trying. And I think most
sure,
landlords
at least you're
would
trying.
Work with
that's,
you.
That's right. That's right. As long as you're trying to pay, I mean, your landlord probably knows that you're out of a job because of COVID-19
right.
and you have no income, but he has bills to pay too.
Right. And now, if you do that, you know, I always recommend that they work with you if you were representing a landlord. But we've had some tenants, okay, some. And I'm just saying this is anecdotal because these are clients.
Right.
That
sure.
The landlord says, I have the money. I was receiving $740-something dollars, but I am not paying you because I don't have to. And a lot of those.
See, that's not fair. That is not fair.
And so they're, you know, but they're, and they know that, and they're taking advantage of it. And we've had several landlords who've been without payments for 6 and 7 months. And they understand. They say, we don't have to pay you. And I think their solution is, we'll stay here for a year. And then if we do eventually get evicted, which will take another 2 months to get evicted after this
right through the courts,
comes
right?
Off, then I'm going to find someplace else to live, and I'll live somewhere basically for free for 12 months. Now,
Doug, take a breath. Michelle, how do you feel about this?
Well, you know, you're looking for the word fair, and when somebody says that, I always, you know, it for a lawyer, if you're looking for fairness, you're not going to get it. This is just the situation with COVID right now, and, you know, we have a lot of clients who are who've been hurt by it, and We just have to dispense what's going on. We can't control it.
Well, you know, I feel sorry for those. I'm really sad that people are out of a job. It's not their fault, but you got to pay rent.
Yeah.
Well,
I don't know how you're going to do it, but you have to.
I think what you do is if you're suffering hardship and you're a tenant, have communication with your landlord
right. And
give them good faith payments
right. To
demonstrate that you really want to live there and you're doing what you can and you're being, you know, you're trying to be, I don't say fair about it, but you try to work within the limitations you have. And if you do that, I think that would be very, you know, that you, I think it could be worked out. So there's always two extremes to both sides.
Sure.
But, you know, I think one of the things that landlords are doing is that if you're not paying rent and you have something broken in your
They're
your
not
place,
fixing it.
They're not fixing it, you know. So okay. They deduct it from okay. your rent, you know. So
I don't want to hog the whole hour, so I just need an excuse to talk to you guys.
All right, my man. Justin. All right.
It's been a long year. Take care of it. Bye.
And your beneficiary check is not in the mail. All right, let's go. Do we still have Junior on, Doug? Or you want to? You want to go to break, or you want to go to? You want to go to Junior? Whatever you want to do. All right, let's go to break. Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demers, Cinceri, All Things Legal. We'll be right back after this brief timeout. Hey, we're back. Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demers, Cinceri, All Things Legal. You can also call us at our law firm at 504-837-1304, Michelle, on the North Shore.
985-624-9697.
All right, let's go to Junior. He's got a question regarding construction. Hey, Junior, you're on All Things Legal. Junior, my man.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
All right,
this is my first time calling. I listen very often, pretty often. I am a general contractor. Build homes, renovate homes, things of that nature. And I'm one of the good guys. I really run into issues, really run into problems. However, sometimes I do with malicious clients. And my question is, in my contracts, I've been doing it for many years, and I'm just calling to see if it's effective or if it's right or wrong. I have written in my contract, in all of my contracts, that if a dispute arises between me and the borrower or client, that they will pay all of my attorney fees. Is that something sufficient?
No, absolutely. That's great. That's a great. That's very wise, because a lot of times if you don't have that attorney fee provision in there, if you sue and you prevail, you have to eat your own attorney's fees unless you put it in writing and have it acknowledged in writing by the other party or have it inside your contract. So I would say anytime you do a written contract for any type of service, if you can, I would put a attorney fee provision that if you have to enforce the terms and conditions of the contract, that you will be paid. Not and also, too, what I would put actual attorney's fees, not an attorney fee to be determined by the court.
Or not reasonable.
Or reasonable. You say actual attorney's fees, because sometimes the court will assess attorney's fees, but it may not be what you actually incurred. So I would put actually incurred attorney's fees, costs, investigative costs, and other related costs in your contract so you can do that. And that's a very wise thing that you have done, and that's a great thing for you to do to protect yourself.
Okay.
All right, my man. All right, my man, Junior. Thanks for the call. Okay, let's go to
Peter.
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 Got taxes question. Hey, Peter, my man. You on All Things Legal.
Good morning. How are y'all this morning?
We're doing great, Peter.
Okay. My question, I don't know if you can answer it or not, is there a point in life where you don't have to file income taxes anymore, like, because you don't make enough money?
In this life,
in this life,
in this life, you're referring to even you even have to file taxes when you're in the next life.
You
got
do.
Enough. Yeah. I think if I would defer to a CPA.
I don't think so, but I would defer to a CPA.
I'd defer to a CPA, but I would think that you would have to file, whether you have to file a dummy return to say zero. If a CPA wants to give me a quick answer, I would say it's always safe to file a tax return that has nothing on it, so at least the government's apprised that you're not having any income. So I would do that, but I would defer to a CPA. All right.
Right, because I only make like $1,000 a month on Social Security, and I'm thinking that's not enough to even file.
Tell me if I'm wrong. Is it the requirement to pay or the requirement to file? I think it's the requirement that you file.
To file, yeah. I think you're supposed to file.
You're supposed to file.
Now, realistically, I mean, if you get audited and you don't make any money, I don't know what the purpose at all, what would be accomplished in the audit. But I would say right. I think you would have to file. And, you know,
okay.
like some people have to keep filing taxes, like Mr. Benson. I think he's going to be filing taxes for a long time for his estate. So even after this life, sometimes you have to do it. So I would defer to a CPA.
Okay.
And, all right, my man. Thanks
for calling.
Thank you all very much. Yeah, y'all have a great morning.
Okay. Yeah. Yourself.
Did you? Yeah, that's an interesting question.
Well, it just goes to read. I mean, you know, when we do succession work and stuff, back before they raised the death tax, you know, you have to file returns.
Yeah, I mean, typically, when you even if you die, you file a tax return at the end of the year of the death, even if it's usually there's some kind of interest on a bank account, even if they're retired and. You know, those are...
Rarely do you have somebody die where it's a proper time and you don't have any kind of tax issue.
Right. So it's that's a good question. And I like you, Junior. Junior's a regular listener. If you're a businessman, you do contracts.
Yeah, because a lot of people think that if you sue somebody, you'll get your attorney's fees.
I know.
Attorney's fees are only by statute or by contract.
You know,
and there's places in the law that gets it.
You know, it's a common question we get. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, you got Facebook now.
Right.
And somebody will say, hey, somebody defamed me on Facebook. I want to sue them. And I said, what did they defame you about? You know, and they said, you know, I was drinking latte coffee and, you know, instead I was drinking tea or something, you know. I don't know. It's just dumb things. And so I said, okay, you want to sue? I said, well, you know, I guess how much money, you know, you got to put a retainer down. They said, wait. I don't get my attorney's fees if I win. I said, most of the time you don't.
Nope.
Only time you do is if you're getting, you know, if it's in writing or if it's an open account under certain circumstances. If you provide, like if you're Office Depot and you have an open account where you get supplies or you're a supplier, like you sell electrical electrical equipment to a general contractor and they don't pay. Or you might have a lien, but for the most part, you don't have attorney's fees.
No, and if you file suit, you don't get attorney's fees.
No, so just keep that in mind. Because what you have to really do when you decide whether you want to sue someone for something that's not monumental is whether the amount of money that you spend justifies the possible return.
I always tell people, you can sue for principal. It's very expensive.
Right. I only knew two people I work for who could sue for principal, and they both own the Saints.
There you go.
Everybody else can't afford to sue for principal, for the most part. All right, let's go to a break. Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demmer Cinceri, all things legal. We'll be right back after this brief timeout. Hey, we're back. Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demmer Cinceri, all things legal. I'm going to get a little serious, but we'll start this before the break and start after. I want to, you know, when I see things in the media, things being reported that are totally incorrect as a lawyer. Because, you know, a lot of times if you're a doctor and you go to a little party or something, somebody and you got a sniffle, people start saying, you know, asking the doctor, what's going on here?
Right.
And you're like, he's like, you got a sniffle, you know.
Right.
But they get questions. And we get the same thing. And I've been asked a lot about what's going on with, you know, the recent instances with Jacob Blake.
Okay.
And after the hour, I'm going to break it down and identify the real issues. Because, like, if you have a roof leak, like a lot of people had hurricanes, and if you have a roof leak, right?
Right.
And you want to fix the problem, and the roof leak's, you know, is leaking to your floor, is mopping the floor fixing the problem?
No. You got to go to the root of the problem.
You got to go to fix the problem. And I want to do that. But, you know, I think one thing, like, we talked about Coach O.
Right.
But love guy. And one of the things, and I'm doing this for the benefit of people so they know, at least when they're out there in public, you know, displaying their opinion, they're doing it on correct facts.
Correct.
And not a shallow narrative without facts.
Okay.
But, you know, like Coach O, you know, he called Coach Carroll over at Seattle, wanting to know, how do you deal with this upheaval for my team? And he has asked him for suggestions. I'm going to give Coach O two suggestions, whether he wants it or not. He's going to get it. But, and I don't mean it disrespectfully, but I think number one, you know, this team's very vocal about things that have occurred before, is one, I think he would do his team a service by if the kids don't want to practice one day, is taking them to the World War II Museum and get the most knowledgeable person at the World War II and take them the entire day so that they could have a different perspective as to what they're seeing right now as far as what was sacrificed so that we can have the right to protest our country, even dislike our country, or dislike a lot of things that occur. But at least you have the right to do that.
Right.
And I think that would be very good to see that, because they could see all the blood that was spilt so that they could have the privilege of playing in front of 103,000 people in Baton Rouge. Just get a different perspective. Let them make their own decision.
Right.
Now, the second thing I would recommend he would do, and I'm volunteering our own Newell Norman, who's, you know, he's on from 10 to 1 every day during the week. Invite Newell, who's former police chief of Jefferson Parish, to speak to the team and have a very honest and frank conversation as to what occurred with Jacob Blake and the problems he, as he sees it, and see what the real problems are.
Right.
And let the players see a point of view that is real, because I think Newell would be, he was a Jefferson Parish, he's a beat, he, you know, he's on the beat. He was police chief. He was, he's in the media now. He's got a very balanced view. And he could identify the concerns and say, this is what it is, and this is what it's not. So that the players could have information that they could think for themselves and make their own decisions.
Well, not only players, but just the whole, just everyone in general.
Yeah, everyone in general. But, you know, the LSU players are very high profile. And I think that would be very good for people. You know, I think he would be good on Airline Drive to find out from a police officer's standpoint the difficulty of making, you know, these type of decisions. Because, you know, when you knock on a door, first of all, when you're a police officer and you kiss your wife or husband goodbye, that might be the last time.
Sure.
The rest of our jobs is not like that. And so after the break, I'm going to break down this Jacob Blake factually,
okay,
without narratives,
okay,
without any political spin, and say what the real issue is so that if people want to address it, they can address the issue and not use it for other purposes, you know, for their own political, you know, for purposes, whatever
right.
that may be.
All right, right.
And so I thought, you know, and we're going to do this in the context of a bar exam.
Oh, okay.
A, B, C, and D.
Okay.
Multiple choice.
All right.
And then we'll see if, you know, see if anybody has a problem with it or agrees with it or disagree with it.
Okay.
So I think it would be fun. So we're going to take, and a bar exam is a proficiency exam that is taken when you don't have a pandemic for law school graduates to make sure they're ready to practice law. So we'll be back next hour. We'll have a national news, local news. We'll be back in 10 minutes. Stay tuned. Hey, we're back. Hour number two, Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demers, Cinceri, all things legal, my law partner, my wife, mom of our children.
There all you the go. Above.
All of the above. Give us a call, 260-1870, or you can check us out on Facebook. We're streaming live and from the
beautiful Mandeville.
Beautiful Mandeville.
It looks like a beautiful day out there.
It is. It looks fantastic.
I wish it was like 70 degrees.
Yeah. So... I know. Well, we're about 3 weeks from a cold front. Football weather. Hopefully,
yeah.
We'll have football for football weather.
Hopefully.
You curmudgeons, let us play football. All right. All you people who don't want us to deny us from enjoying our South Louisiana culture, which is God, hard work, food, football, festivals,
there
and family. All right. What I want to talk to you, and I want to try to be as factually based as I can.
Okay.
So that people understand what really happened with Jacob Blake from a factual standpoint.
Okay.
Because I think it would be fair to say everybody's using it for their, I guess, their...
agenda.
Agenda. There you go. And I just wanted to say, and I wanted to ask your input, too, on one of the issues that were involved in Jacob Blake that happens commonly.
Okay.
It's okay. So you had Jacob Blake in Wisconsin. Police received a telephone call.
Okay.
From a white police officer, from a black alleged victim, or she said she was a victim, calling saying that I had obtained a protective order against Jacob Blake.
Okay.
And I feel like I'm in danger. He has sexually assaulted me. He has stolen my vehicle, and he has stolen my credit card. I need help.
Did she have already a standing
TRO? Yeah, she had a TRO. So, okay. First of all, I want to ask you, one,
sure.
What is a protective order in Louisiana, and what do you have to do after one is issued, even if you don't believe you're guilty of it?
In Louisiana, if you are a victim of a domestic abuse,
okay.
And there are many definitions, it would take me too long, but it could be a dating partner, it could be a family member, it could be a husband, it could be a wife. If you have had either, you can have cyber stalking, which is getting to be common now. You can have physical violence, but it used to be you had to have an actual physical violence. Now we can have cyber stalking. But you have to have belief that your life is in danger. Okay. And so you fill out a form, you fill out a petition, it goes to a judge. If the judge feels like the facts as stated, perceived as true, warrant protection, then an immediate order is signed. That defendant is then served. The order, as soon as the judge puts a signature on it, is a standing order. But the defendant cannot be held to be in violation of it until he or she is served.
Okay, now.
Once they're served, within 10 days, you have to get into court. With COVID, it's been pushed back. And then you have a hearing to determine whether the immediate action, the restraining order should stand.
Now, from the time period between one is issued, signed by the court, and between the time period of the hearing.
Right.
Does the alleged perpetrator or defendant have to comply with the terms of the stay away portion of the protective order?
He or she does.
He or she does. And what happens if they don't?
Well, that's what I was saying. If they're served and they violate it, then they can be thrown in jail.
Right.
But they have to have been given notice. They have to have been served.
And they could even be thrown in jail, even if it's determined later that they didn't violate, that a protective order permanently should not be.
Correct.
So just to make it clear, if a protective order is issued against an individual and they go to trial and you still have a duty to comply with the stay away order.
While it's in force
and before the hearing.
Correct.
Even if it's determined later that the protective order was issued improperly.
Correct.
You still could have committed a crime.
Correct.
By violating.
Correct.
In the interim.
Because you're violating a court order.
Okay. So in the Jacob Blake, you had a woman call who said that my boyfriend or, you know, is violating a protective.
Now, I'm going to say, it might be different. I want to say I don't know Wisconsin law.
Right. Well, it's a violation, basically. So we're just taught, we're interposing Louisiana law, and we sort of just taking a leap as far as Wisconsin law. So sure. There was some type of protective order in place, TRO. And she said she was sexually assaulted, stole a vehicle, stolen credit card. Also, there was a charge, previous charge of some type of sexual assault.
I don't
in some
know that.
Form
I'm
fashion.
Assuming you're
that's,
telling
that's,
me that's
from
correct.
Reports. From okay. reports. Okay. Now, when it comes to when the police officers come to the home, first of all, there's non-compliance with orders as far as the arrest concerned. It was reported that there was a tussle, that the Jacob Blake was tased, and it was still non-compliance and resisting arrest. And what the police officers perceived him, we don't know if it's true or not, reaching for a knife, and then he was shot 7 times.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't done anything. So
research.
I'm assuming that you're telling me that.
Okay. And I guess to the extent that we don't know the facts because there's going to be an investigation.
Sure.
We're doing this as a hypothet,
okay.
I guess, so that we're not
okay,
defaming
anybody. Okay, so this is a law school hypothet.
So this is a hypothet.
Okay.
Now, in this particular case, if you want to define the issue,
mm-hmm.
The issue is what is the appropriate use of force for a person resisting arrest who may have been perceived as a danger to the victim, danger to himself, or danger to the police officers. Is
okay.
that?
Yeah, that would be. Yeah, if this was a hypothetical and I was trying to pull out the issues for a law school exam, I would be taking a look at what you just said. I would be taking a look at what are my facts, what are the facts that were given to me, and what is the issue?
And so as far as defining the issue, which I think is very important, like, you know, we're talking about the roof leak.
Sure.
is you got to define what's causing the roof leak. You know, mopping up the floor is going to do it. Is the defining the issue in the Jacob Blake matter is what is the appropriate use of force after a non-compliant alleged perpetrator mm-hmm. who may be perceived to be dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a fair?
That's a fair statement. That's a fair issue.
And so I think that issue is not – that's a very narrow issue.
Sure.
And as far as interposing, it could be for incompetence. It could be for lack of training. It could be from just fear mm-hmm. of a young police officer who overreacted.
Okay.
But I think if people want to debate that issue, I think that's a very fair question.
Sure.
Is, you know, what is the policy of police departments on dealing with a non-compliant alleged perpetrator or suspect, alleged suspect who is non-compliant
right.
with police officers and is resisting arrest to the extent where they were tased and physically resisting arrest.
Okay.
What is the department's policy as far as dealing with that? Do you let them go? Do you, you know, what's the proper level of use of force? Those are some hard questions.
Those are hard questions.
And
you have to remember that the officer is all this is going through his brain in a very short period of time.
You know, I always say, you know, people think it's hard for Drew Brees to throw a ball 30 yards when you got 300-pound linemen after you. But let me tell you something. That's nothing compared to being in a situation like this.
Sure. And listen, these police officers face these situations all the time.
Right. And we're going to – I will say, we're not taking a position on this because we have opinions, which I'm not going to give, but I'm not taking an official position. But it is something that I think merits thoughtful discussion, thoughtful analysis. But I think it has been totally skewed for other agendas,
sure.
and that's not the issue. Now, I'm going to say this about the police officers. You do a lot of protective orders.
I do.
And we do a lot of them, and we defend people at times, and sometimes we help prosecute them.
Sure.
I will say this about the police officers. A lot of them, I've seen so many situations where these police officers have done a fantastic job of diffusing a highly volatile situation and resolving it in a way where nobody was hurt. And it was done with the thoughtfulness, the skill, and putting their life on the line.
Mm-hmm.
You would have a situation where maybe there was a dangerous weapon. There was a situation where someone was impaired through drugs and alcohol. You had a lot of high emotions.
Mm-hmm.
You had, you know, and they were very, very, they put their life at risk. And they were very, very wise and thoughtful in diffusing a lot of situations that when they do that, it's not going to be posted on Facebook. They're not going to get a medal. They're not going to get accommodation. They're not going to have a sticker on their helmet or anything like that. They do that without recognition.
Right, because it's their job.
That's their job. And that's why I think, you know, I think Newell Norman has talked about that, is that I would, if people really understood what the real issue is, instead of misappropriating the issue and hijacking it for some other agenda, but really the Jacob Blake issue is the appropriate use of force
right. For
a non-compliant suspect who is perceived to be dangerous. Now, it's a fair argument as whether 7 times being shot is too much.
Sure.
But I think everybody needs to be heard as to how that occurred before you start making your judgments and trying to understand, especially maybe if you're a Loyola student or a Tulane student or LSU student or you at Audubon Park protesting or you're an LSU football player, is that I would try to get knowledge on the other side, get the other point of view, and understand it would be much like maybe it's like saying you know Joe Burrow threw a bad pass under pressure. Not to say that is comparing the two, but that's the type of pressure that you're under as a police officer that is underappreciated. Now, if a court, an investigative agency, would hopefully they're impartial, would come back and say, no, that was an inappropriate use of force and sanction that, that's fair. If they said, well, you know, under these circumstances, maybe, you know, based on the training and instructions you have, it's not the kind of result that we wanted, but it was, we're not going to sanction it. Well, maybe, you know, that's to be determined. But before everybody gets, you know, makes their own conclusions and attaches certain people as being bad, attach people with motives, look at the facts. And I think if you look at the facts, most of the motives that are attached in these, in a lot of this discussion does not apply to this situation. That's just it. All right, well, let's go to break. Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demers, Cinceri, All Things Legal. We'll be right back after this brief timeout. We're back. Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demers, Cinceri. You know, being on the show with me, you learn – I'm a history student.
I know you are.
So you learn a lot of LSU history, right? Football history?
I do.
All right, I got a text.
Okay.
From Jamie. It said, why did Jerry Stovall leave? No, I know. You were starting your freshman year. Jerry Stovall was coach.
I know.
His last year. Hmm? Y'all had a, when you were a freshman, they had a hard, bad team.
I know we did.
But what happened was Jerry Stovall was hired after Bo Ryan, was 7-4 the first year, didn't go to a bowl, right. But did a little better. It was sort of a lot of term upheaval with, you know, Bo Ryan gone. The next year they were 3-7-1, I believe. And that was my sophomore year at LSU. Then the following year they were 8-3-1. That was a year in the Fog Bowl. They beat Florida State, I think 55-21 maybe, with Bobby Bowden. You know, Coach Bowden. And so they hit. And then they lost to Nebraska 21-20 in the Orange Bowl. You remember that?
I think so.
Then the next year, they went 3-8, didn't win an SEC game.
Okay.
And they lost to Tulane.
Oh.
I know. And so he was let go. I don't think he really had an opportunity to he didn't have his – he just came in difficult situations.
Right.
But he was second in the Heisman Trophy voting, I think, in 1961. He's probably one of the top – he's in the Ring of Honor at LSU.
Wow.
And he was a great man, very, very great man. Also, got another comment about Albert Whitlike. Said, nobody has done less with more than Coach Miles. That's for Albert. I like Coach.
Uh-huh.
He's a quirky. He was good. He got a national championship.
Guy.
He is quirky, huh?
He was
a fun quirky. So there you go on that. And I'll give some Saints news. I'll talk about the old Saints.
Okay, what's the old Saint?
Today's Hokie Gaijon's birthday.
Oh.
He's been 61.
Hokie.
And then I didn't really know Hokie. He was a scout when I was doing the Jerry Maguire thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I used to bug him about my players. He was very nice because I was probably pretty obnoxious young kid trying to get my players.
Really?
Oh, yeah. He was a great scout. I mean, because he was a good scout because he had good ability, but he could look at players and had a sixth sense about him. Like Bumfields, you could look at a player and sort of just get it.
Right.
And he was a great scout, which a lot of people don't know. He was a fantastic color announcer because he could – spin it in a way that we all understood.
Right.
You know, like a kid from Bucktown, you know, who hung around Bucktown like myself could understand it. And then yesterday was Billy Kilmer's 81st birthday.
Ah.
Now, Billy Kilmer was, when I started working for Bill Becknell, the first week I worked, he tells me they're opening something. Kenny Trahan was going to open up the Saints Hall of Fame in the first two. I think Billy Kilmer was in the first or second class of the Hall of Fame. I'm not sure. He says, I'm a little busy. You're going to have to entertain Billy for a day or two. So I got paid to entertain Billy Kilmer.
That must have been cool.
Oh, I was 20-something years old. I was just all ears, man. And he's involved in one of the most famous plays in NFL history. When Jim Marshall ran the wrong way, I think in 1963, he was playing wide receiver for San Francisco 49ers. He caught a ball up the middle. He fumbled. Jim Marshall from the defensive end from the Minnesota Vikings picked the ball up and ran to the wrong end zone.
You got to be kidding me.
No. It's on NFL films. They don't show
that.
NFL films like they used to because, because it's old school. Like some of the NFL films, the older ones,
right.
They would show the players smoking on the sidelines. They really did.
Having a drink, having a smoke.
They having a smoke. I think Davey Witzel. I mean, Daniel Brown will tell you. They showed like cutaways. You know, the offense is on the field. I mean, sitting bench and you know, there's a fumble. They take their cigarette, they throw it on the ground, stomp it out, and they run on the field. Boy, what would they do today? You know, they have protests and everything for that. So, happy birthday, Billy. Happy birthday to Hokie in heaven. He is in heaven too, but he's in the wilderness section of heaven. You know, where they got the hunting and the fishing. I'm not going to go to that part.
No, you will not.
I'm going to go to
you'll be in the air-conditioned portion.
I'll be in the air-conditioned portion of heaven. So there you go.
That's funny.
So also, there's going to be high school football everywhere but Orleans Parish probably.
Really?
Yeah, they're going to start. I'm glad, you know.
Can the private schools agree to go play in a different parish? Can they play
please,
games?
I think so. I think they're going to probably try securing it. I tell you what, I just saw the statistic that they had 63% increase in shootings in New Orleans. And so the solution to that is to take away high school football in Orleans Parish. Now, I hope we're prevailing the people from Orleans Parish. Please let them play. This is so important.
And it's really a shame for those poor kids, especially, you know.
You learn teamwork. You learn respect for authority.
But
you learn
your senior and, year, your junior senior,
oh my
year,
goodness.
And you're showcasing. I don't know.
So,
it's just a shame.
Kudos to the LSHAA.
Yeah, absolutely.
And kudos, you know, to saying, hey, you know, these kids need to be playing football, and we're very glad. And I'm waiting for Friday Night Lights. I think we'll go to a St. Paul's game
just to
take it all in and watch the socially, you know, we'll even watch the socially distanced bands play, you know. all right. So, you know, we're talking a little bit about temporary restraining orders.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about that.
Okay.
In Louisiana, you know, the domestic violence has been an issue, and they have put new laws in for protective orders, and you can get in a lot of trouble if you get a protective order against you. There's a lot of implications to it. So if you want to tell us a little bit about that and what could occur and how they're issued.
My main knowledge comes with how it affects custody.
Okay.
And so I try to stay out of the criminal aspect of it.
Right.
So I don't do that portion of it. But in 2018, our state became one of the strongest domestic violence states, and our custody laws were changed with respect to any parent who had a history of perpetrating family violence. So it doesn't really just mean whether it's in that marriage or that situation. It could have been violence when you were a younger kid. You could be 40 and have some kids, and you had a protective order against you when you were 18, and that still comes into play now. It hasn't been on the books long enough where we've seen appeals come through yet to really figure out exactly how that law is going to be applied. But now, at least in St. Tammany Parish, where we really strongly, our judges enforce it, is if you have a parent who has a history or any kind of domestic violence order against them, that affects their ability to have custody of their children. And if you have that, in order to even get supervised visitation with your children, you have to go through a bunch of steps, which are good steps if it pertains to that family, and if that person, it does have a history of violence that has not been addressed yet. The issue that becomes, what if it was 20 years prior and you've changed your life? And those are the kind of cases where I'm interested to see how our courts of appeals going to come down. But now when I'm sitting with somebody and I have a protective order against my client, it gives me an extra step to have to go through. My client will then have to do 6 months of
treatment. Yeah, let's talk about it. So if someone feels they're in danger, lack of a better word, and they could file a protective order. And what happens originally when you first file it? What does the judge do with it?
Well, like we were talking about before with the Blake issue, you put a petition before the court and you alleged the incident that brought you here and in any past incidents. And if the judge feels like there's enough on the face of the petition, meaning you've said enough that if it was all true, an order should be placed, then you will get a temporary restraining order.
And what does the order say now?
Order, Oh, well, it could, I mean, it
like,
could be
typically,
a
typically,
order.
But typically.
Typically, if you have kids, it'll give sole custody to the parent who's making the petition. It'll affect the house. But it's essentially what it says is that parent cannot come within 100 yards of the spouse or the children of their workplace. I mean, it would take me 15 minutes to tell you everything.
Yeah,
that's
but
in the
so it's basically a stay away order.
It's a stay away order.
And then you'll have a trial probably within 10 or 15, you know, with, you're supposed to have a trial within 10 days
correct.
To determine whether that protective order
should stand.
Now, if the court decides that it should stand, and I think typically is the, basically the court would say if the person, I always explain it this way, if the court believes that you're in imminent danger,
right.
that they're going to grant it.
Correct.
Based on past behavior
correct.
Or recent behavior, what are some of the implications for the person who has a protective order?
Now I want to say this for anybody listening: this has nothing to. This is not when the state takes a case. This is when it's
private.
In a civil. This is in a private civil area. That what happens is if the court grants the protective order. The perpetrator or the defendant right then and there, at least in St. Tammany Parish, has to object on the record. You file your appropriate pleadings, and then you go on to the district court.
Now, what would be the sanction if you're ultimately determined to have a protective order has been issued against an individual? What are some of the things they have to do?
For custody?
For custody. And what are some of the implications? What are some of the rights they may use?
Well, if a protective order, if one is granted, then it goes in the National Registry. And so it's sent out, you know, on the National Registry database. And so that's how it can affect you everywhere. If you have custody issues, then what happens is you have to go through 6 months of Truth 180, which is a domestic violence anger management program. It's called the Duluth model. You have to be free of alcohol or drugs. And you really have to have, come to the court and essentially letting the court know you've addressed your issues.
Now, you also have some other sanctions, such as you lose your right to firearms. A lot of hunters aren't happy about that.
No, they're not at all. You have to turn in your guns.
It goes into National Registry, mm-hmm. and also, too, in order to get unsupervised visitation with your children, you have to go through a program.
Well, the new law says even supervised.
To get supervised,
you have to be in the program and you have to have done it. And then this is where I was talking about. I'm not quite sure how our First Circuit and then if it actually goes to the Supreme Court, it's going to fall down on it. But it says that, you know, you have to prove that the other side's just as bad in order to get joint custody. So those are just kind of new rules that really have not.
It's a big deal.
It's a huge deal.
It's a big deal. It could affect your ability
really
to see your children and affect your ability.
I tell my clients when I represent the men and there's any kind of issue, walk around with your hands behind your back and do not even be in a situation where there can be an implication or an allegation that there could be any kind of domestic violence.
All right. Let's take a break. Doug Cinceri, Michelle Temer, Cinceri, All Things Legal. We'll be right back after this brief timeout. Hey, we're back. Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demers. Cinceri, South Louisiana. You know, they're playing that disclaimer more and more. I wonder why.
Not in the commercial.
Calling from where we're speaking, South Louisiana.
There you go.
Place of God, hard work, food, football, family, and festivals, none of which you can do in Orleans Parish right now. All right.
You can do them here. We went to a festival yesterday.
Yeah, it was great.
It was hot.
It was an antique festival.
Antique and Crafts in Covington.
You know, antiques is a new thing for me here. I never realized there was so much antiques in this in this world. I mean, they're everywhere.
I know, and every time you take me, I know how much you love me.
That's it. So I did find I found some good books.
You did.
I found a book on the Book of the Governors, which was great. Mm-hmm. It ended with Edwin Edwards, his third term. That's how old it was. It was very good. All right, let's go to the phone lines. Let's go to Jason. He's got a question. Hey, Jason, you on All Things Legal with Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demers, Cinceri. Jason,
yes,
my man.
Can you hear me?
I hear you good, brother. What you got?
I just wanted to comment about the whole domestic violence situation.
Okay,
thing.
Sure.
Especially, especially if a child's involved. Like, I actually have seen it to where men and women use it, but most of the time I see women use it more than men to throw out domestic violence on a guy that they have a child with just so they get a better verdict in family court because, I knew a couple, and one of my best friends, he got a domestic violence charge on his record, and it was basically her word against his word in Orleans Parish Criminal Court, and he fought this for about 8 months and wound up losing. So I really don't have no respect for the Orleans Parish Criminal Court system because I feel like they're only looking for conviction. And, like I said, and then in 2017, they made it non-expungible even for first-time offenders. So for people who have children and everything, it's like the people that run this state, they really make it hard for families, especially they got a lot of good men out there that I know have been charged with domestic violence probably over the past 10 years, and it has ruined their life to where I know two people who committed suicide over it. So men have a hard time, more harder than women, especially when you got a parent that's going to two courts and trying to work full time and trying to do what he got to do to take care of his child, and then you have a system who just like, hey, if a woman goes on the stand and puts on a few fake tears, then you know what? I'm a convicted guy. I'm not saying all women are lying, but they got a lot of devious women out there.
All right. Well,
I can't give you any comment on Orleans Parish because I don't practice in that parish. But in St. Tammany Parish, I know that our court system struggles with the protecting women and protecting children versus the chance of it being a unreasonable or not a warranted charge or not a warranted petition.
Or I think what the call is referring to is sometimes we've come across a situation. Sure. We had one in Jefferson Parish where all it was turned out to be about was mom trying to get an advantage in a custody.
Oh, absolutely.
And it turned out to be totally baseless.
And we see that all the time. And hopefully if you prevail upon the court, they'll see that. The problem is when these judges are brought these petitions, it is their call, just like the police officers when they go on a call and they knock on the door. They have they're having to look at do I grant it because this person needs protection? Or is it not true? And if they don't sign it, and then we have a killing, which we've had at least three of them that I know in this parish, then they're on the line. So it's a call, and it's a judgment call. And in our courts, at least in St. Tammany Parish, do err on the side of caution.
Right.
And then
can you
a
hear
lot
me
of
too?
Yeah,
I can
yeah.
hear you. They err on.
Oh my bad. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, you go. You
go ahead.
You go ahead. Go, Jason.
I was going to say, in one situation with the domestic violence charge that I know about, like 2 years later, the woman wrote the letter, the judge a letter, and it was like, I went through with putting a charge on my ex because my mother at the time, I didn't have no place to go, and we had a one-year-old child, and she said basically if I don't make the charge stick because she didn't like the dude, her daughter's boyfriend at the time because she felt like he didn't make enough money for her daughter. So basically when they had a breakup, she made sure that her daughter put a charge on his record. And then like 2 years later, she's like, you know what? She felt guilty about it and then wrote the judge, which the judge is Arthur Hunter. He's actually running for district attorney right now. Wrote the guy a letter and let him know that, hey, like such and such happened. I wound up doing the wrong thing and getting somebody convicted. And I think she handed him that letter like a year ago, and the guy never even got back to him or nothing.
Yeah,
you know?
I cannot comment on any of that.
Well, I think a couple of things what I tell dads to do, like Michelle referenced, is that you want to stay out of a situation that could be misinterpreted.
Right.
And so if you think that situation is applicable, like Michelle said, you just sort of keep your distance, walk with your hands behind your back, and if it gets heated, get out the house.
Right.
But there's two sides of it, and this is where attorneys struggle. This is where judges struggle. You got to figure out, especially if you don't have any extrinsic evidence to otherwise, is this a real domestic violence, or is this a situation where one parent is trying to gain an unfair advantage over another parent in a custody matter? Because the courts do err on the side of caution when they initial the orders. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, that's what cross-examination's for.
Sure.
That's what the evidentiary hearing. Hopefully you have a good lawyer who can draw it out. Now, a lot of times if there's a lot of inconsistencies by the alleged victim, if they can't give dates, time, and places, if their testimony doesn't match up, you know, hopefully the judge will pick it up and not issue the protective order.
And I always try to tell my client, it's the public policy behind it. Domestic violence is real. Women and men both are harmed. Children are harmed. And so that's what our courts are trying to weigh when they see the initial protective order.
Yeah, but, you know, you bring up a very good point, a concept that is a real concern. It's a real concern that the courts struggle with. And thanks for the call. We got to go to a break, Jason. That was a very good call. We got to go to a break. Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demers, Cinceri, All Things Legal. We'll be right back after this brief time out. Hey, we're back. Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demers, Cinceri, All Things Legal. You can also call us at a law firm at 504-837-1304 in Metairie. Michelle in the North Shore.
985-624-9697.
And, you know, we got a couple of minutes. We're going to be on next week. The Saints play at 325, so we'll be on our regular time. 8
Are they
to
playing
10.
At the Dome?
They're playing at the Dome in front of the ushers. And, you know, yeah. So they planted the Dome. No crowd.
Gotcha.
All right. Also, so we'll be on next week. And
Albert will be back.
Yeah, Albert will have waken up from his slumber. And he'll be back. He's off, not working this weekend. Also, too, you know, we got a couple minutes. You know, I'm such a history buff.
I know.
Thank you, Brian Altobello, my 10th grade teacher at De La Salle. He's fantastic. Everybody should have Brian Altobello as a history teacher, and everybody should go to the World War II Museum, and they will be very thankful they live in this country. But so in history, you know, I love to do this day in history. Christopher Columbus left the Canary Islands this day in 1492. Canary Islands, those islands right under Spain.
Yeah.
And so heading to the great North America.
Where was that? Where was that place we went to, one of the islands?
Jamaica. Where the bay he landed, man. Yeah. Oh, I love that, man. I was rolling around in the sand where he landed, right? So, Christopher Columbus. So, for you millennials, they used to have a lot of statues of Christopher Columbus up, but I don't know if there's
any
left.
Did we take him down?
Oh, they go after him, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, why? What did he do?
Oh, gee, I don't know. Brought disease with him or something. I don't know. Huh. All right, in 1901, the 25th president, William McKinley, was shot in New York at the Pan-American Exposition Fair in New York, and he died 7 days later.
Wow.
And guess who became the 26th president? One of the greatest of all time, one of my favorites.
I don't know.
Theodore Roosevelt. He was a great president. He used to have a hat, red hat, that said, "Make America Great." Millennials might believe that. Oh, they're able now. No, he was a great president. Very interesting president. You know what? He wasn't like party-lined. He did what he thought. Like some things progressives like he did, some things right. I mean, he just did what he thought.
Huh, sounds like our president now.
We do that. And you know what happened this day in 1975?
What?
Chris Evert won the U.S. Open against Ivan Gulagon.
You know, I think
just that's a natural progression. You know why I mentioned Chris Evert?
You had a crush on her.
Oh, my goodness. She took me brought me right into adolescence.
That is so funny.
She did. I played tennis back then.
I know you did.
And they said, "Who was your favorite athlete?" Chris Evert. Who's your favorite girl? Chris Evert. Who did you want to marry? Chris Evert. So anyway, congratulations, Chrissy.
There you go.
If you're listening to me, send me your autograph or something. Send me your picture. That's my priorities, huh?
Hanging on the wall.
See, it's great to fill 5 minutes. So anyway, we used to play a lot. Tennis was big back in the 70s.
I know. Listen, that's what we sat around and watched. My family didn't watch football. We watched tennis.
Every at Lakeside Country Club, we would have a big Wimbledon party.
Yeah, we belonged to Beach Club.
Beach Club always beat us. Mm. I could never beat Beach Club. Timmy Siegel played for them. I used to be happy if I got a game off of them.
It was fun.
So there you go. So anyway, there was no law, but a little history in that last segment.
Yeah.
So anyway,
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you. Thank you for coming. Thank you for traversing
the hallway
and waking up. It's nice not driving the bridge. So we'll be on next week on All Things Legal. And, you know, so y'all have a great Labor Day. Jerry Lewis isn't on this year, so we're going to miss that. And there's no hurricanes in the Gulf.
No hurricanes. Praise God. Be quiet.
All right, so we'll see you next week on All Things Legal. Be good and be blessed and have a great Labor Day. Enjoy yourself.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.